Today is Wednesday, November 14th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, firefighters are making progress as the death toll rises in California, where wildfires continue to devastate.
It's just almost too much to take. It really is a strain on it. So now I have to reinvent myself all over again and start over creating a life, basically.
CNN sues the Trump administration over its decision to bar one of its journalists from the White House. The president says it's fake news, as a new report shows North Korean secret missile sites. Also ahead, craft gins and distilleries showing up in bars across South Africa. It's all on today's International Edition. Authorities searched Monday for more than 200 people who are still unaccounted for as fires rage in northern and southern California. At least 44 people have been killed. President Trump on Tuesday offered his support.
We mourn the lives of those lost and we pray for the victims. And there are more victims than anybody would ever even think possible. I want to thank the firefighters and FEMA and first responders for their incredible courage in the face of very grave danger. Yesterday, I signed a disaster declaration for the state of California. We will do everything in our power to support and protect our fellow citizens in harm's way. And we say, I think as a group, I can tell you as a group, God bless everybody. That's a very tough situation.
Mike O'Sullivan, VOA's Mike O'Sullivan, reports from Los Angeles and tells us more than 220,000 people have been displaced by the blazes that have reduced thousands of homes and businesses to ashes.
The so-called Woolsey Fire continues to rage in Malibu and other coastal communities near Los Angeles. Among the 370 structures destroyed there have been the homes of celebrities, including the actress and singer Miley Cyrus. North of Sacramento, most of Paradise, a town of 27,000, was burned to the ground, and authorities continued the grim task of searching for bodies. Monday, fire officials near Los Angeles said new outbreaks are still occurring.
Within the last hour, we had two brand new starts, and obviously it just hits home on the fact that we are still in significant fire weather, and the existing fire is not our only concern.
Displaced residents are trying to come to terms with the destruction.
There's whole neighborhoods that are just gone. Streets, rows and rows and rows. My daughter's house and her mother-in-law and husband's house, every house on the street is just gone.
As firefighters search the smoldering wreckage, they report progress in some places, but say the two major fires in the state are far from containment, and more winds and dry conditions are forecast. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
President Donald Trump has weighed in on a report that North Korea has more than a dozen undeclared bases capable of hiding missiles, calling the report fake news. In a tweet on Tuesday, he wrote, "The story in the New York Times concerning North Korea developing missile bases is inaccurate," he said, referring to information revealed in the report from the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies. He went on to say, "We fully know about the sites being discussed, nothing new and nothing happening out of normal." He also said he'd be the first to let us know if things go bad. The CSIS report released Monday said its conclusions are based on commercial satellite imagery, interviews with North Korean defectors, and interviews with U.S. intelligence and government officials. It said the North Korean bases, which can be used to house ballistic missiles of various ranges, are well hidden, indicating the North's determination to conceal its military abilities. VOA's Victor Beatty asks Stephen Norper, Senior Director of the Korea Society of New York, if the president's tweet and nonchalance about it are surprising.
It doesn't, in that I think we can assume that the United States has known about these facilities for a while. The report that was posted was done under the auspices of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And what it does is essentially show that there are a number of sites and that there may be 20 undeclared sites. But remember, North Korea hasn't agreed to any type of closure of those. And what it does remind us is that we need to move toward negotiations that lead to a declaration of nuclear and missile assets and verification. It reminds us of the importance of the road ahead and the need for arms control and disarmament.
A South Korean spokesman also said the North is not necessarily being deceptive to South Korea or the U.S., so apparently the U.S. and South Korea are on the same page.
Yes, it appears so. The White House has said, or at least Trump has tweeted, that this is no surprise. And we saw the Blue House move rather quickly to say that North Korea is not in violation in the sense that they didn't have an agreement. However, you know, it's not in the interest, obviously, of either Seoul nor Washington to have North Korea with these sites. And again, a reminder that these are critical security issues that require us getting to the negotiating table with North Korea to address what they do have in terms of missile and nuclear assets.
CSIS expert Victor Cha, who was a top advisor to former President George W. Bush, said the report by CSIS underscored the risk of the president accepting a bad deal in which the North only dismantles its most visible weapons infrastructure.
But there's no deal at this point. So that's the point, in essence, that supports both the Blue House and the White House in terms of their contention. Clearly, there's a need. There's no deal on the table. And the summer summit between Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, while high in terms of theatrics and symbolism, didn't really lead to much by way of any kind of agreement. So we need to get to that stage, whether through leader summits or senior working level meetings. There are important issues that need to be addressed.
The president told a news conference last week he was in, quote, no rush on North Korea after a senior delegation abruptly canceled a meeting with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in New York. Was that a concern?
Well, clearly we're going to see setbacks and we'll see cancellations, and those are normal by way of North Korean negotiating behavior. I think what we do need to accept is the North Koreans were signaling their displeasure over the U.S. insistence on the maintenance of sanctions at the current high level. And that was their way of signaling that they're unhappy about that and they'd like to see some sort of sanctions relief. They also would like to see things like humanitarian assistance. And right now, U.S. humanitarian heads through NGOs have been prohibited from visiting North Korea, and that's hurting U.S. humanitarian efforts. And so they're unhappy about that. So there's a bit behind the scene, but the fact of the matter is we need to expect this process to be slow, and it's good that we give it time. That's just an admission de facto by the administration that these things are complex, and we began with the leaders' summit. Now it's time to try to put things on the page at the senior working level. So it will be a complex road ahead.
An analysis piece by one media outlet said that the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has not retreated from his pledge to expand his operational force of nuclear bombs and ballistic missiles. And it says as time goes by, the North's likely expansion of its arsenal could force Washington to rethink its insistence on full denuclearization.
Well, that's a possibility. We need to just make the assumption that the North Koreans are proceeding with their program. They haven't committed otherwise, though they have introduced a few things this year worth noting. The missile and nuclear test moratorium as of April 30th, and the closure of some of the Sohae satellite site and the destruction of the nuclear test facility entrance. They see those as a contribution or something that they're providing on the upfront. That said, there hasn't been dramatic progress, and we need to assume that the amount of plutonium or uranium that's being harvested really means they have a yield for a nuclear bomb about every 6 weeks. It just means we have to get to the table, and we really need to strike at denuclearization, but the reality increasingly is that may be partial. We need to get something in the near term. Clearly, you want the elimination of a clear and present danger of a nuclear and missile threat, but there may be more attainable goals in the short term by way of disarmament.
Stephen Norberg, Senior Director of the Korea Society of New York. Tensions remain high as both Israel and the Palestinians in Gaza blame each other for rising aggression. The surge in violence over 2 days was triggered by a failed Israeli undercover raid into Hamas-ruled Gaza on Sunday. Palestinian groups Tuesday said that they accepted a ceasefire mediated by Egypt after Hamas fired hundreds of rockets into southern Israel, hitting a populated town of Ashkelon, where local resident Bitman Mimon lives.
I live here next door. Yesterday night after 12:30 was a big bomb. I go down Chibchak because I am an ambulance driver in the army. And this house was in fire.
Israel responded with dozens of airstrikes. The Palestinians say at least 7 people were killed. Egyptian mediators are due in the region Wednesday after the worst cross-border violence in years. Correspondent Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
In a statement, all the organizations in Gaza said they had accepted a ceasefire mediated by Egypt. Egypt's efforts have been able to achieve a ceasefire between the resistance and the Zionist enemy, the statement reads. The resistance will respect this declaration as long as the Zionist enemy respects it. Israeli officials did not comment. But Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had repeatedly said that Israel does not want a war in Gaza. Analysts say that neither side wants war, but previous ceasefires have been derailed by events on the ground.
The UN Security Council has failed to agree on any action in the fighting between Israel and Hamas. Israel's UN ambassador said Security Council members that want to blame Israel for the latest fighting with Hamas are, quote, morally bankrupt, and rejected those who call for restraint by both sides, portraying Israel as a victim. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Ex-intelligence officials are worrying Trump's tweets are leaving the U.S. vulnerable. The U.S. is losing its luster for foreign students. Turkish President Erdogan ups the pressure on Riyadh over the Khashoggi death. And the trial of a Mexican drug kingpin begins in New York. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The cable news network known as CNN is suing the Trump administration over the suspension of correspondent Jim Acosta's White House press credentials. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports from the White House.
The administration revoked Acosta's press pass after a contentious news conference last week when he refused to yield the mic as President Trump told him to sit down.
You are a rude, terrible person. You shouldn't be working for CNN.
CNN's suit says the White House violated constitutional rights to due process and freedom of the press. Trump spokeswoman Sarah Sanders says the administration will vigorously defend against the suit, which she calls more grandstanding by CNN. Sagar Magani at the White House.
Well, joining us now to talk more about these developments is Alex Tarquinio, president of the Society of Professional Journalists. Thank you very much for being with us. Has your organization taken any position on the situation of CNN filing suit against the Trump administration for barring their reporter?
We strongly condemn this action on the part of the White House. It's something that our board has discussed extensively since his pass was revoked last week. This is unprecedented thus far in the Trump administration, but we mustn't forget that many actions have been leading up to this one.
They are also threatening to do this with other reporters. Some are speculating that they're just trying to shut the White House press corps down.
It is a muzzling effect, and I think that this administration has been testing the limits of their power, frankly. If they can get away with it, I mean, that's why this lawsuit that CNN has filed is absolutely crucial. If the White House gets away with this in one instance, I'm fairly confident that they will try it with other media outlets. So this is really a very serious lawsuit that CNN has filed. It is not simply about reinstating one reporter to the White House press pool, but it really is about freedom of the press, and that is not just for the press, that is the public's right to know. If the president feels that he can muzzle any reporter in the White House pool who asks questions he doesn't like, then he will continue that activity.
Historians have had a hard time even recalling a similar type of episode, and beyond that, there were some statements made by Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders about what actually happened, calling Acosta's behavior inappropriate, saying Jim Acosta pushed or slammed an intern that was trying to take his microphone away. And then Sanders went so far as to post a video on Twitter that we learned later was doctored. And it was actually she retweeted something that had been shared on social media that originated from a conspiracy theory website.
Yeah, this is really shocking because this incident happened in a room full of reporters who saw, they witnessed the incident firsthand. Any one of those reporters would have said if there had been any inappropriate physical contact, and there clearly was not. By now, I hope that everyone has seen the undoctored video. We've seen the intern, a very young person, who reached across him physically to get the microphone. We did not see any inappropriate contact. I mean, the fact that a doctored video was shared, there are doctored videos all the time on social media, and we should be aware of this. As journalists, we are very aware of it. One problem is that it is becoming much easier for even people with unsophisticated skills to doctor videos. It's called deep fakery, where you can actually take a photo or a video and make it look like someone said or did something that did not happen.
How surprised are you that the White House itself would be putting out this kind of false information to sort of discredit a journalist who was asking questions they didn't like?
I'm very sad to say that in November of 2018, I'm actually not that surprised. If this had happened 2 years ago, I would have found it mind-blowing. But, I mean, this has been a progression of events that has gotten us to this point. Day by day, this administration has been pushing the envelope on how much they can place blame on the media for questions that they don't like. But they are challenging it. They are pushing that envelope a little bit more each day, which, again, is why this lawsuit is so terribly important.
Well, do you think that the president does have any authority to pick and choose who or what journalists cover him and what questions they ask? Because Jim Acosta is known for definitely being aggressive and trying to get answers that the president really doesn't want to talk about.
I mean, that is a complicated question because obviously they do grant credentials for the press pool. Jim Acosta is a very senior reporter in the press pool, but by taking away his credentials because he asks questions that make the president uncomfortable, we at the Society of Professional Journalists believe that that is limiting the freedom of the press. If this becomes a pattern with this administration being able to remove journalists, it could potentially have a chilling effect.
What about the argument the White House says that Acosta was not being respectful because he continued to ask questions after not letting other journalists speak? And, you know, even after he was asking follow-up questions, wouldn't stop when they were trying to go to other people?
There's a difference between respectful and agreeing with someone. Mm. I mean, I feel that his questions and those of the other White House reporters are all respectful of the position of the president. They all address him with the proper protocol. They are respectful. They stand and they ask the questions. That doesn't mean that they're going to ask questions that the president's going to find comfortable. And they are going to ask follow-up questions, particularly when they feel that the president's answer has been evasive. Now, the White House has said he asked two questions which the president answered. The fact is, if any politician gives an answer that's evasive or doesn't really address the question, any experienced journalist is then going to try to ask a follow-up to ask the question in a bit of a different way. And this is something that I think the public who are not journalists may not understand. They're like, well, why is this journalist asking the same question again and again? Well, that's what we do. We ask the question in a different way, hoping to elicit a more full response.
The president really didn't. Some have said that the president, if he really believes Jim Acosta asks unfair questions, why does he keep calling on him? And some would speculate that it's because the president actually wants the confrontation. Do you agree?
That's an excellent point. The fact is, the president does choose who to call on. He doesn't have to revoke Jim Acosta's press credentials. He could just call on him less often. The fact that he has chosen to do this indicates that perhaps he feels he's getting good press out of it, that in fact he is scoring points with his dedicated followers who enjoy watching him, play the tough guy.
That's Alex Tarquinio, president of the Society of Professional Journalists.
This is Today in History. On November 14, 1982, the Polish people celebrated the communist government's release of Lech Wałęsa, leader of the outlawed Solidarity labor movement. After house arrest for 11 months, Wałęsa's public support and leadership forced negotiations between Solidarity and the government. This eventually led to elections in 1989 and a Wałęsa presidency in 1990. In 1832, the first streetcar in New York City debuted. The fare was just 12 cents. On this day in 1851, Herman Melville's novel Moby Dick was published. Moby Dick is now considered a great classic of American literature.
On this day in 1889, New York World reporter Nellie Bly, Elizabeth Cochran, began her attempt to surpass the fictitious journey of Jules Verne's Phineas Fogg by traveling around the world in less than 80 days. Well, she did it in record time, finishing the journey in just 72 days. On this day in 1922, the British Broadcasting Corporation began domestic radio service from Marconi House in London. Today, the BBC is one of the largest broadcast operations in the world. In the early 1960s, a visionary named Phil Knight started a small shoe company he called Blue Ribbon Sports. But on this day in 1972, he changed its name to Nike, today one of the best-known shoe brands in the world. Composer Aaron Copland was born on this day in 1900. This is from Appalachian Spring, perhaps Copland's best known work. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Well, as the Democratic Republic of Congo battles the spread of the deadly Ebola virus just across the border, Ugandan survivors of a 2007 outbreak are reminded of the near-death experience they went through. Bundi Bungyo district at the border with Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo faced the brunt of the disease as both health workers and residents lost their lives. Halima Athumani reports from Bundibugyo in Uganda.
Health worker Samuel Kule in 2007 was attending to patients with mysterious fevers along with his brother who was also a health worker.
And within 2 days, my brother also was affected. So I attended to my brother also. And after 2 days, he was referred to Bundibugyo Hospital and he died in Bundibugyo Hospital.
Kule also became infected, and it was his blood test that confirmed Uganda was facing an outbreak of Ebola. Chachimwa Jacobet lost two brothers and a niece to the virus and became infected herself. She recalls the stigma and rejection of being linked to Ebola.
Even those we shared meals with, those who spent their days with us, suddenly never wanted to be around us. When I was admitted to the hospital, the landlord evicted my children out of fear that they would infect others with the disease.
Before the 2007 Ebola outbreak was contained, 149 people were infected and 37 died, five of them health workers. With Ebola spreading once again just over the border in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Uganda is screening border crosses carefully. Uganda's Ministry of Health sent a trial vaccine for frontline workers like Francis Muhindo, who fought the 2007 outbreak.
The threat is that any time anybody can contract it from Congo, cross up to here, and maybe we get in contact with such a person and have a, and contract the disease. So, if I'm immunized, I think I will be safe.
The Ministry of Health says 20,000 people cross the border each week, putting Uganda at high risk of another Ebola outbreak. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Bundibugyo.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
The 2019 VOA calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture U.S. byways, including beautiful photos of the Big Sur Coast Highway and even the historic Route 66. Tune in to Border Crossings at 1500 Universal to request a free calendar.
The VOA's International Edition continues. A recent proliferation of craft gins and new distilleries have taken over South Africa's bar scene, but this is not your average gin. Distillers say South African gin is infused with unique local flavors like Finbos, Rubios, Marula, and other distinctive South African botanicals that they feel will take the world's taste buds by storm. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Gin Town, also known as Johannesburg.
Gin is in South Africa. In the past few years, artisanal gin has exploded on the scene of a nation better known for its wines. At this Johannesburg wine shop, sales manager Tabang Mamkeli says they stock several dozen South African gins, but can't keep them on the shelves.
We play around with more, you know, botanicals and just trying to do something different. Like I said, we're not governed by rules.
Craft gins are reinventing the colonial era image of a spirit once used to liven up anti-malarial tonic water. This popular Johannesburg gin joint is living proof. Gin is cool. Workshop 55 offers numerous international and local gins, expertly mixed. Owner Julie Solero says of all the drinks in all the world, she's thrilled to see gin taking off in South Africa.
I think it's been big in the UK now for, 10 years, quite a number of years, and only really big in South Africa, I would say, in the last 4 or 5 years.
Dozens of craft distillers now crowd the market, offering a taste of South Africa with unique, local botanical flavors. But this is not your grandmother's gin. Nick Taliakis, sales manager for 2-year-old distiller Ginologist, says he thinks South African gins can go global.
The flavor is immense. It pops, it explodes in your mouth, and it really feels you wishing to both have more and to go out and try so many other gins.
Distiller Curtis van Biljon infuses his brew with rooibos, an earthy tannic leaf commonly drunk as tea. He says it blends well with gin's citrusy, herby base flavor, the juniper berry.
The reason gin is first is because the distillers like myself getting on making craft products, gin has the shortest maturation period and we have the most flora available to us in South Africa for testing and being able to try new products and be creative with.
At the wine shop, Mamkeli says he expects South African gin to take off internationally.
This is us bringing what we do best to them.
It's too delicious, he says, to keep in South Africa. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Well, if you're really lucky and live in the U.S. cities of Houston, Indianapolis, Los Angeles, or Sacramento, you now have access to a 5G network. If you live anywhere else, just be patient. A 5G mobile network is coming your way, and it's already arriving in some countries. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
In the tiny state of Monaco, on the Mediterranean Riviera, the future has arrived. These antennas are upgrades that will allow Monaco to handle the increased demands that 5G devices will put on networks.
We are in the process of installing the antennas on pretty much all the roofs because the aim is to cover the whole of Monaco. It is the antennas you can see behind me that we're in the process of installing, and they will allow us to cover the whole principality, to have coverage everywhere inside.
What is a 5G network? Without getting too deep into jargon, it will give your wireless device the ability to do a lot more of whatever you do online, and do it faster and more efficiently.
5G is 10 times stronger, so that allows us to provide coverage for all multimedia uses for the many more people who will be connected. 5G reduces the connection wait by 10 times, and therefore we can connect immediately, and that is essential for new uses such as connected cars. And 5G also allows at least 10 times as many connections per square meter, and that is a very important factor in the technological revolution.
But the networks they need to work on haven't quite caught up yet. Experts say as our lives, our homes, and our cars become increasingly wired, we're going to need all that new bandwidth. A few U.S. cities have pockets of 5G, but don't expect the speedy new services to really get rolling until the end of next year or even into 2020. Besides Monaco, it's no surprise that the countries that are most likely to roll out 5G first are South Korea, China, Japan, and the United States. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.